Okay, Mr. Wade.
Morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. Your Honor, this case is here on a sustaining of a summary judgment, so probably the, which seems to be a familiar reason why I'm down here. But so one of the most familiar things is that we have to take all the evidence and draw all the inferences in the favor of the non-movement. When you do that, to me, there's no question in this case but which this confession was involuntarily obtained. Without trying to go into the details of it, I just want to refer Your Honor specifically to the affidavit of Sharon Clay, which is 839 to 843 on the record, the testimony of Deputy Whitfield, who basically supported what Mr. Edmonds was trying to tell the judge about it, 269 to 273. And then we got several false confession experts in this case, one of which was Dr. Saul Kassim, and he does a detailed analysis of this confession on, beginning on page 954 of the record. Your Honor, just in bare summary, what happened in this case was that Sharon Clay, when she brought a 13-year-old child up to the Sheriff's Department at their request, specifically told them, according to her affidavit and according to a part of the transcript from the confession, that I'll sign this Miranda right, you can question my child only if I'm present. That's the way you can do it. And then through subterfuge, by telling her they just needed it, to, after going round and round with him, according to Deputy Whitfield, and trying to get a confession out of him and not being able to do it, they separated the mother from the child by telling her he just needed to talk to her for a minute, told the child they were going to have him out of the room for a minute, took him out, questioned him for about 45 minutes, still weren't able to get a confession out of him, and then went in and brought the lady who had accused him of the murder, his adult half-sister, into the room. She held his hand, according to Tyler. She said, tell him. And they had already worked it out that he was going to take the blame for it, and he came up with this bizarre confession, which ultimately, as Your Honors know, the Mississippi Supreme Court ruled we didn't get a fair trial and reversed the conviction. We got back and got a not guilty verdict, and we're now here on a suit against the Oktibbeha County Sheriff's Department. I believe the case is so strong that this confession was not voluntary is the reason that defense counsel, whom I frequently litigated against, is very skilled, did not even argue to the district court that the confession was voluntary. The district
court. What do you do about your client's statements on Dr. Phil, the TV show?
Well, Your Honor, all that's just a question of fact for the jury. I mean, that's just a pure credibility question. We have to disregard all the evidence in favor of the defendant, draw all the inferences in favor of the plaintiff. Look at what I might suggest, if you're going to look at the plaintiff's evidence, look at Dr. Schott's testimony on page 706, 707 of the record, a state psychologist. Dr. McDade, 710, saying that this influence of the girl was a cause of his making the confession. Look at the affidavits of the experts, three defense experts in a criminal case were put in there, whom all testified that the bringing of the child and separating her from the parent was a cause of it. All that, we have to draw all the inferences, disregard everything favoring them, and it's up to the jury to draw the inference as to whether the confession was coerced.
But, well, help me out here just back at the beginning. What's the constitutional right and who deprived it?
Well, there's several, there's at least two constitutional rights. There's a Fifth Amendment constitutional right to be free from coerced confession.
But that's really only 14th, right? It's got to be through the 14th because you're suing state actors.
Yes, sir, but, well, actually, in the 14th Amendment, Your Honor, we have a substantive due process claim.
Right.
That is the deprivation of the family right to privacy. That's a 14th
right.
Amendment substantive due process right. And the Fifth and 14th, I understand what Your Honor is saying.
Yes.
But the Fifth Amendment, as incorporated in the 14th, is the right to be free from coerced.
Yes. Okay.
Confession.
So it's essentially you're saying a 14th Amendment right to be free from coerced testimony.
14th and Fifth.
Yeah. Incorporating the Fifth Amendment. I mean, it's important to get it right. Okay. So if that's the case, because everyone's talking sort of loosely about the Fifth Amendment, if it's the 14th Amendment right to be free from coerced testimony, the Supreme Court has said as a matter of law, not as a matter of fact, you can't have that type of coercion where the state actor is not the one motivating the confession, right? That's the Colorado versus Connolly case.
That's correct. I think we should have had summary judgment as a matter of law. However, I agree with that. I mean, I agree with that. Those cases that go up on criminal appeal and say voluntariness is a question of law for purpose of the habeas corpus statute. But here there's a little different overlay on it because we're on a Rule 56 motion and the Seventh Amendment, and we take the evidence in the light most favorable to plaintiff. Now, we could file our motion for summary judgment. We ought to get it. We should get it, as a matter of
fact. But I guess I'm guessing you, even factually, here, the ruse, however horrible it was, didn't begin at all with the police. They were as much suckered. In other words, you agree with me that the child has said throughout, before the confession, then subsequently in the presence of his mother, confessing again, then again to Dr. Phil on TV, my sister did it, not the police.
Yes, sir, but the police are involved in it. It's like Atticus Fee Crasher.
Okay, well, then here's, excuse me, what's your best case that Colorado versus Connolly doesn't control because you say the police were involved? What's your best case that this sister was brought in as an agent of the police to get him to confess, as opposed to the sister coming up with it independent of the police?
Your Honor, he's drawing all the inferences in favor.
No, I'm just asking you for your best case.
Well, here's the case, Your Honor. There wouldn't have been any confession to the police if the police are not jointly involved with the child. The basic fundamental law under a joint action between private parties and state actors is it's color of state law. The police brought her in and said, would you tell them what you told us?
And she was there for how long?
Sir?
How long was she brought in for?
Well, the inference in favor of the state, Your Honor.
No, I'm just asking you to answer the question.
20 seconds.
But
we got expert testimony from state's experts that say that was a cause of the confession. That's Dr. McDale and Dr. Schott, 710 and 706.
Mr. Wade, I accept that appears on its face to be the cause of the confession. Is there any evidence that the state was aware in any way of this relationship with the sister, or of any unique relationship with the sister?
Yes, sir, there was. In fact, one of the deputies that was involved knew the family, and he gave contradictory testimony. I can't cite the record site, but I asked him when we were doing the suppression hearing, didn't you know about how much influence she had? He first answered affirmatively, and then the district attorney asked him a very leading question, and he changed his mind, but he was well acquainted with that family. And there's contradictory testimony on that, but that again is a fact issue.
He was acquainted with the family, but I'm having the problem. The difficulty for me is the question of the role of the state here.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Judge Higginbotham, but here's the role of the state. The state questioned this child for approximately 3 hours. I mean, that's the total of it. Right. He started out denying it. We started out with an agreement between the law enforcement officers and Ms. Clay. You cannot question him unless I'm present. Subterfuge was used to get her separated. She's out trying to get to her child so that she can be present. And she's separated from him through subterfuge, and the state made the decision, according to Lindsay's testimony on page 255, the reason that he brought her in the room is that he wanted Tyler to know that she was claiming he did it. The state is intimately involved in it. I really don't believe the issue.
I didn't follow the last thing you said, Mr. Wade, that he wanted him to know that the state officer wanted to know what. I didn't follow.
The Deputy Lindsay testified, and he's the one that's most favorable to the state. He's contradicted a lot by Deputy Whitfield, but he's most favorable to the state. And he says, I wanted Edmonds to know, this 13-year-old child, I wanted him to know that his sister had already told us that he, Tyler, did it. That he's blaming you, that he says you did it. That was the purpose for bringing her into the room, because the purpose for bringing her in there was to induce him to change his story. His story was that he was given a false story. I didn't know anything about it. He did know that his sister had done it. She'd admitted to him about a day. So he was, and I understand they're both involved in it. It's state action, and it's also action by the girl, and of course she's primarily responsible because she rigged the story for him.
It's an unusual case. That's why I'm looking for any case law that's helpful. It's unusual where you have this, I think everyone agrees, the sister, independent of police, at the outset tried to set up her brother. That's right, you agree with that.
Yes,
at the way beginning. And then after the confession, the son, the brother, again says it was the sister, not the police. So it's a very unusual case, but you're right. They brought her in for those moments. And does that alone create state action? You're saying it does. I'm wondering what cases exist. But you've made your case. I understand your point, and I appreciate the record cites. Let me ask you another question going to your second point. Mississippi law, as I understand it, says you have a right not only to be notified as a parent, but then to be present. That's correct? Except in capital cases. So if If it's a question of state law, because you convincingly say a lot of states have these laws, how can it then be a constitutional right to always be present? If states are experimenting, some giving them rights, some not, Mississippi seemingly oddly giving you no right to be present in the worst type of cases. Do you understand my question?
I think I do, maybe in part. It's not the fact that it might does or does not violate state law is not controlling here, Your Honor. The question is whether it violated the United States Constitution. And it does. I mean, a lot of states would say it violates state law.
Right.
But in this case, and you know, counsel's saying I'm trying to change the law. What we're really trying to do is to apply the law to these facts that the Troxell case, the United States Supreme Court has already ruled on. It's settled law.
But so, what about the validity of Mississippi's law that says in capital investigations is that just unconstitutional?
I argued to the district judge it was, but I decided not to pursue it on this appeal. So that's basically where I think it is. But I didn't think I'd get a ruling like that, and I decided not to.
Right.
Not to appeal it.
Well, you know, Mr. Wade, it's not uncommon, I think, in these interrogation situations for law enforcement to bring in family members or a different family member to try, in the supposition that they may very well be willing to talk in the presence of one, not the other. What's inherently coercive about that?
Your Honor, we got three expert opinions in the report that say it's inherently coercive. And the United States Supreme Court in a 2011 case that just came out observes that it has in several cases that police questioning a child at a police station in itself is inherently coercive. And the Miranda warnings normally, in a normal case, the Miranda warnings would mitigate against that. But in this case, we have a case
well,
where...
Well, I would understand that in the context of interrogating the child without a family member present. That certainly would raise some questions about the inherent coercive interrogation. But when one family member is substituted for another...
Your Honor, here's what we got in this case. We have the family member, the half-sister, whom the police, they believe she's committed the murder. That's probably what they believe she either committed or was involved in it. But she's given them a statement saying that Tyler, the 13-year-old child, committed the murder. They know, according to her statement, according to what she's told them, it's not like we brought in a family member to get the confession. We brought in a sister. We took out the family member that was supporting the child.
Right.
We brought in the family member with an interest in putting it on him or trying to get herself out of it.
But is there any evidence that the state knew that the sister was implicated in this crime?
Yes, she'd given them a statement that she was there when it happened. And she claims that they had been talking about using a gun and it was an accident. I don't think her confession, her exact confession's in the record, right. But the record is that she said he did it. I was there and he did it. Tyler did it, 13-year-old child. That's what she said. She was already under arrest. Your Honor, I didn't, let me mention a minute the state court rulings. They're claiming that the court's bound by the state court. Under Mississippi law, there's no majority opinion from the Mississippi Supreme Court. The concurring opinion that does address the confession is totally contrary to federal law. Judge Randolph's opinion where he says, it doesn't make any difference that the child, you use the same standards, and then gives deference to the ruling of the trial court. That's totally contrary to federal law, and it's only a concurring opinion. Under the cases cited, it has to be a majority opinion to have any effect at a future court.
Excuse me, Mr. Wade, before your time runs, could you comment on the limitations argument?
No, sir, I didn't. And here's the only thing I can say about that. As to Tyler, that wouldn't apply. Certainly as to Tyler, the child.
Right.
The parent-child relationship protects the parent and the child. As to the mother, it's just not realistic to say that while we have an ongoing criminal case, any civil case would certainly have to be stayed, and the damages aren't complete until his conviction's overturned by the jury. I have it in my brief. I really haven't commented on the causation issues, Your Honor, but that's all discussed in the brief. The one thing I'd want to say about that, if I got another minute or so, is I hope I know it's a tough it's tough to talk about these two Fifth Circuit cases that have opposite results, the Murray and the Brzezinski case. But if a court adopts and goes along with the Murray case and says Brzezinski's not the controlling case, we have a judicial modification of 42-1983, which essentially says that Fifth Amendment claims aren't actionable under 1983. It's just a judicial modification because it's almost impossible. I've tried to come up with how could you ever have a Fifth Amendment right if you don't have it here? And it's almost impossible to imagine that there ever would be a case where you could have a Fifth Amendment claim. God, I see my time.
Yes, you saved time for rebuttal, Mr. Wade. Thank you. Mr. Right. O'Donnell?
May it please the court, good morning. I think the overwhelming reality in this case is that the police were unwitting foils to a scheme cooked up by the sister and Tyler together, that Tyler would first, although he knew about the circumstances of the murder from the sister before police even approached Tyler, that Tyler would first deny knowledge. And if the police didn't buy the I don't know version of the story from Tyler's viewpoint, that Tyler would then confess upon a cue by Christy, the sister. And that's exactly what happened in this case.
But the trouble, I mean, your opposing counsel has just said, if they are unwitting foils, uninvolved, then I'm sympathetic to that point. But if the mother came in and said, I want to be near her, I sign this Miranda waiver as long as I'm with him, and I take it that's a fact in the record, yes, then the police are a little more involved saying, no, we're going to separate you, then if they knew how close their other target was, right, the sister, who even was seeking custody of this boy, I think is the evidence, there's some evidence of that, and then they order the mother out and they bring her in, and the last thing I'll say factually, if I understand the facts right at the summary judgment stage, is that they even say to the boy before the sister comes in, and she's putting it all on you, that's beginning to look like state action.
Well,
it's not just an unwitting foil. That's the police involving themselves and using her as an agent.
Well, ultimately, Your Honor, I think the facts as you stated are correct. But I would say that the ultimate issue, if we disregard the Murray versus Earl case and the superseding cause issue, and just look at voluntary issues,
right,
if we just do that, I think what we're looking at is overall the overwhelming reality is what Tyler said, Tyler voluntarily said. Tyler was on a mission.
Yeah, you say overwhelming reality, but we're at the summary judgment stage. If we take all facts in favor of them, is it indisputable that it was voluntary?
You look at the complaint allegations, lays out the fact that Christy...
Do you have any case that says the fact that he spoke to public national TV later and said it wasn't the police, it was her? Is there any case that says that that's sort of like stepping in at a guilty plea and saying it was voluntary, I agree under oath?
Well, I'm not aware of any,
yeah,
but I would say that, again, what the complaint allegations are and what the trial testimony was from Tyler, what the suppression testimony was during the hearing, all consistently said that I was told of the murder before the police contacted me. Christy asked for my help. Christy told me to deny, and on her cue, then I was to admit guilt. The police had nothing to do with that. Police were merely a backdrop to what the real story is in this case. And that is that Tyler would take the blame to save his sister. And he, in fact, told his mother during a break in the questioning that on that day of interrogation,
but
that
it's interesting that he never actually does that. He never, quote, takes her cue until the police bring her in. That's the only time he does it.
That was the cue. Of course, the police were not aware that that was the cue.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
And I think Mr. Wade overstates the police's, the sheriff's department knowledge of this relationship or close relationship between the sister and Tyler, to the extent that Tyler would be overly influenced. I think the testimony was they were generally aware of the relationships involved. Obviously, Tyler spent the weekend with the sister, but I think you'll see the testimony and suppression hearing from the mother that she trusted Christy, the sister, implicitly with the child.
Mr. O'Connell, let me ask you a question about Judge Kitchen's admission of this statement at trial. What was the contest over the admissibility at trial?
Well, number one, Mr. Wade, who's here arguing before the court this morning, represented Tyler during the suppression hearing and the criminal proceedings. Judge Kitchen's full-blown suppression hearing lasted most of the day. A number of witnesses on both sides were called. The evidence from the experts that Mr. Wade is citing this morning presented before Judge Kitchens. Full-blown review of all of the arguments that are being made before this court about why that confession was not voluntary presented to Judge Kitchens.
Was it essentially the same argument that's being pressed in the civil suit?
Yes, sir. Exactly the same argument. No question in that regard, as Judge Biggers' opinion, I think, reflects that. But there's a second trial and a second judge, because Judge Kitchens recuses himself. A second judge looks at the same evidence. There's not another hearing because there's not any new testimony to introduce in terms of the voluntariness of the confession is concerned and the legal issues presented, he finds that as a fact in his order when he confirms that based on what the Court of Appeals, the Supreme Court had done with regard to the issues and then what transpired before Judge Kitchens, that he confirmed that it should be admitted. The Murray versus Earl case says that is a superseding cause. There's no question in this case about whether the police weren't fully candid with Judge Kitchens or with Judge Howard, or there's nothing in the evidence to reflect that Mr. Wade was contesting the version of events as they transpired through the course of the interrogation that evening. Those are all facts. There's no real dispute. There's nothing in the record is reflecting that the police were giving one version of the day's events and Tyler and his mother were giving different versions of the events that would impact the issue of voluntariness. So I think the Murray versus Earl case.
When we look at the videotape of the confession, does it include Christy walking in, or is it just afterwards the boy confessing? Does it describe to us the police interaction with Christy? Is it on videotape?
It is not on videotape. There's the initial questioning when the first Miranda rights were issued and signed by both the mother and Tyler. There's a period of about 30 minutes to 45 minutes worth of questioning. They inform the mother and Tyler then that Christy is telling them through a statement that Tyler committed the murder. So the mother and Tyler are both aware at that point that that's the accusation from Christy. Tyler doesn't believe it, and that's what prompts the police to say, well, if you hear it from her, would you believe it? He said, yes, I would believe it if she said it. Well, of course, when they bring her into the room for the 20 seconds or so, she doesn't tell Tyler what she said. All she says is, it's time to tell the truth. I've told the truth, you tell the truth. And Tyler takes that.
Are you suggesting that he asked her to come in?
Well, police said, would you, if you hear it from her, so there's a, yeah. He says, yes, that would, I don't believe you that Christy's saying this about me. So they said, okay, we'll bring her in and let you know basically from her own mouth what she is saying, but she doesn't actually say that. All she says was, it's time to tell the truth. So there's no suggestion from Christy, actually, about what to say.
Is there anything in the record that suggests the police were unwilling to take his several-day-later retraction? Or were they the ones that memorialized the evidence that becomes the most exculpatory for him?
Well, right. There's another videotape.
Yeah. That's where he said it was all wrong.
There's a second videotape where Tyler, who is in jail, convinces the sheriff, because Tyler, at that point, is a public defender. He can't get a hold of him, so the sheriff is then inclined to go ahead and speak with Tyler directly without counsel, and he allows Tyler to make this second statement on video where Tyler basically recants the previous confession.
Okay, so there's nothing in the record that suggests the same sheriffs that are alleged to have coerced an inculpatory statement in any way resisted taking the exculpatory one shortly thereafter?
No, sir. I think they actually went the extra mile. They didn't have to agree with Tyler's request that he give a second statement without counsel. They allowed him to do that. So I think, again, Murray versus Earl pretermits any consideration about voluntariness because of the state court suppression hearing rulings, twice admitting the confession based on all the evidence that was presented in through the course of this case and being argued before this court this morning. As far as the 14th Amendment substantive due process claim is concerned, I think clearly barred by the statute of limitations, as Judge Biggers held. Number one, from Tyler's standpoint, no shock to the conscience sort of in terms of the nature of the interrogation, no allegations about that at all in the record, no evidence. The familiar relations.
Let me circle back for a moment, if you would, Mr. O'Donnell, to the limitations questions. Are you saying that the claims of both of these plaintiffs are barred, or are you saying that Sharon Clay's claims are barred?
Well, if part of the confusing aspect of the case, Your Honor.
The direction of my question is the Heck Doctrine, and which obviously would bar any filing of a case until the conviction were overturned.
Your Honor, I would say the substantive due process claims are barred by the statute of limitations. The Fifth Amendment claim regarding the voluntariness that Tyler raises is not barred by the statute of limitations.
Why?
The
Heck Doctrine is if the prosecution of the 1983 suit would implicate the validity of the conviction, you can't proceed. And then, that to me would mean that you can't really proceed with the civil suit and the limitations would not be running until that conviction were upset.
Well, here's how I would look at it, Your Honor. This is why I said the statute applies to bar the claim on the substantive due process. And that is, the substantive due process tort is committed and is complete upon the commission. Here, the exclusion of the mother from the room, if we assume that implicated the fundamental liberty interest, that tort is complete upon that happening.
Well, yeah.
It doesn't depend on the conviction or the use at trial.
I don't disagree with that, but the difficulty is that the law is you can't prosecute the 1983 case in a sense that you can't proceed with any of those claims that would implicate the conviction. And
that's the Heck v. Humphrey
plainly,
case.
Plainly, the confession implicates the validity of the conviction, whether it's coerced or not.
It would, to the extent that the argument is the confession played a role in the conviction. But that's the Fifth Amendment claim.
Well, it was admitted into evidence.
Yes, sir. But the substantive due process claim does not necessarily implicate or necessarily bring into question a conviction, because it's not the admission into evidence that forms a part of the 14th Amendment substantive due process claim.
Well, isn't the substantive due process claim still a claim for the coercion that the plaintiff asserts?
No, they didn't claim that it was coercive.
Well, involuntary is what I mean, yes. Rendered the confession involuntary, not a voluntary confession.
The way the summary judgment argument was made and the way Judge Biggers ruled on the issue of the substantive due process claim, differentiating between Tyler's claim and the mother's claim, is that the mother's claim does not question the voluntariness of the confession. It only regards whether or not she was interfered with in her familial relation with the
separation
child.
Of the two.
Yes, sir. And that's why it's barred by the statute, because that claim does not necessarily at all have to do with the use of the confession at trial. Let's assume that the trial court did not allow the confession in at all. I think she'd still have a claim that she was purposefully, intentionally, excluded from the room while the interrogation ensued.
But it would be no claim unless there was some consequence attending it.
Unless
if just excluding her from the room would not violate substantive due process. You'd have to add to that the effect of which was to cause the confession. Unless you have some freestanding right of a parent to be with a child outside the context of the trial. I don't understand.
Well, and I think that's the claim here, Your Honor, is that the mother's asserting a right to be present during questioning, an absolute right, regardless of the nature of the conviction, and the exclusion of her from the course of questioning violated her right, and it's a per se violation.
And what are the damages for that?
I don't know what the damages would be, but it would be... It just depends on the facts of the case, but in this case there would be no damage. But it doesn't depend on the use of the confession or non-use, and it doesn't depend on whether Tyler was convicted as a result of the interrogation while she was excluded. That's the Fifth Amendment claim. That's the amendment provision that applies more specifically to that circumstance. That is, the use of a confession that was involuntarily given.
Just so I can be clear, your position is, though, ab initio, there is no such thing as a freestanding parent's right to be constantly in the presence of their child. Is that your position, or you're not? You don't want to reach that issue?
That's our position, especially in capital murder cases. I know there's a counterintuitive aspect to it, but I think that the state there is pronouncing, and I think there's a state interest there to investigate serious crimes, capital murder, and I think that they...
I guess on this line of reasoning, is since Mississippi has a pretty strong parent get to be present when child's being interrogated in all but capital cases, maybe do you know what the consequences are when police still separate the child during non-capital cases? What's the consequence? What's the damage? Is it disciplinary?
Yeah, I don't know what towards law enforcement.
Yeah.
I would suppose so. I don't know what compensatory damages would be due, maybe perhaps punitive damages in order to protect the constitutional right.
Is it correct that the mother said, I waive Miranda only if I can stay with my child? Is that correct or is that an overstatement?
What I do know looking at the suppression hearing and the trial testimony is that when she was taken out of the room, the deputy said, Sheriff wants us to take you out of the room because he's not being totally upfront because you're present. And she said, well, I want to be in there while you're questioning him. Never said, even at the second confession that was videotaped, she never said, stop questioning him. She just said, I want to be present while you're questioning him. So we don't dispute that as a matter of summary judgment.
Who has the control on these facts of the waiver of Miranda rights? The parent?
Who has control of the facts relating to the waiver? In terms of who's testifying or who's providing evidence? I think the deputy and the mother both testify consistently to that she said, hey, you're taking me out of the room. I want to be present while you're questioning.
Well, my question, though, is going to the question of Miranda rights with a minor child and a parent there, and the parent is willing to, as long as she's present, she's willing for a child to be testified, but not otherwise. Why isn't that a denial of Miranda rights to continue interrogation in her absence?
Well, may or may not be a violation of Miranda rights. I think ultimately, though, in this case, Your Honor, that mother enters the room while questioning is continuing, and she, in fact, questions the child on videotape, and he again admits to the complicity in the murder, involvement in the murder.
Let me be clear about the thrust of my suggestion here. One of the issues here is the role of the state and the implication of the state. And what the argument would arise that if the parent controls the Miranda rights and says, I want to be present in any interrogations there, and they continue in her absence, you now have a state violation of Miranda rights, which does tie them back into the coercive. That's another tie-in of the state to the coercive environment that led to them making this involuntary. In other words, I'm just suggesting to you its relevance is not simply as a freestanding right to pursue a Miranda right, which is a prophylactic rule and not a substitute process rule.
Of course, within that, there's the point of whether or not the mother was entitled to be present in a capital murder investigation. I think Judge Biggers addresses that in a summary judgment opinion. That's an issue of law. But ultimately, it's a Murray versus Earle issue, proximate causation. So I think my time is up.
All right. Thank you, Mr. O'Donnell.
Thank
you.
Mr.
Wade, do you save time for a rebuttal?
Your Honor, regarding client's claim that this is only the mother's right, that is just not right. The substantive due process right of the parent-child relationship is a right of both the parent and the child. The parent has a right to control her minor child. The child has a right to the nurturing and advice of her mother. It's a substantive due process right. So there are two separate claims. The Fifth Amendment through the 14th is that this child was coerced. The substantive due process right is that the right to family relationships, and it's not exactly like counsel said, well, that she talked to the mother and the sheriff doesn't want you in here. That's not exactly the way they did it. The sheriff called and said, get the mother out of the room, separate them, and then they went and told the mother that I need to talk to you alone for just a minute and tried to persuade her to let them do it alone. She would never agree. She would just never agree with Deputy Whitfield, and Deputy Whitfield testified to this. She would never agree to let them question him without the child. And then through subterfuge, they got them separated. They put them back temporarily together, And then the deputy comes in and says, I need to see Tyler for just a minute. I'm going to step out with him for just a minute. He stays gone for 45 minutes, where he's telling him, according to them, going round and round with him, telling him your story's not adding up. And moreover, he tells him, your sister is telling us that you did it. We got the statement. There's a dispute between the two deputies. Whitfield admits that Deputy Lindsay waved the statement around and said, I've got the statement here that says you did it, that says you, Tyler, did it. And he said, well, she wouldn't lie on me or something like that. And he says, well, she says you did it. And the sheriff's deputy says to her, are you calling us a liar? She says you did it. We'll show you. And then they bring her in, and she holds his hand. So they're intimately involved in all of it. It's not like, and Your Honor, regarding Your Honor's earlier question, I was concerned I gave an adequate answer, Judge Hickenbotham, but it's not just that this is a relative. This is a relative, a sister whom the child is telling that I have confidence in her, in effect, and is the lady whom the police know is involved in it. She ultimately got convicted of capital murder, and even though she's given a statement that he did it, the police know that she's bound to have been involved in it. She was the one as a licensed driver that was over there. Your Honor, I really do not believe that this involves any novel principles of law. I believe what this involves is applying the Troxell case from the United States Supreme Court, involves interpreting all the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. And if we're ever going, Your Honor, if we're ever going to have a 1983 cause of action, surely we would have it in favor of somebody who's 13 years old and, according to the jury, is innocent of the crime. It spent 4 years in the penitentiary. If we're ever going to have a 42 U.S.C. 1983 Fifth Amendment claim, this would seem to be the appropriate time for it. Your Honor, if Your Honor looks at that, and it is a very compelling confession. I might say the confession is compelling. You look at Dr. Kasim's report, and he says, so what? It's somewhere between 40% and 60%. They've done these experiments, and you can't look at a child and tell whether he's lying and telling the truth. That's just not possible. I might say this. None of the false confession experts were ever admitted into evidence in any trial. For whatever relevance that has, the jury found this young man not guilty and the confession to be a lie without even that evidence. So, Your Honor, we believe there ought to be a remedy in this situation, and we request the court to reverse the grant of summary judgment.
And before you step down, you've lived this case. Isn't it one way of looking at what the police did here with the good lawyering in terms of testing the sister constantly to the point we get the retraction?
I'm sorry, I'm not following you. I'm out of here.
You're saying the jury found it was a false confession, but in to some extent they found it because the police were so insistent to test Christie's theory, no?
No, that's not right, John. In the first trial where he was convicted, the trial judge had ruled the retraction was inadmissible. But it came out on cross that he'd given some retraction, but he ruled it was inadmissible hearsay. But in any event, at the first
trial, the retraction given to the sheriff was not admitted?
He admitted on cross-examination of Tyler. He wrote before trial it was hearsay, and then he used
so
it
to
say... So
not for its truth, just to cross-examine?
Yes, that's essentially it. And by the way, as far as the retraction goes, there are really two sets of law enforcement officers, Your Honor. The deputies that took... They were acting under the direction of the sheriff. He was telling them to separate them and everything, but they're not the ones that took the retraction. Tyler, after he'd given the confession, started saying he wanted to see one of the deputies that had taken it, or the sheriff. And the sheriff's the one that came in, and the sheriff came in and took the retraction. The sheriff himself took the retraction along with some different deputies than the ones that took the confession. I don't know whether that's how relevant that is, but Your Honor was asking that. That's what happened.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Wade. Your case
is
under submission.
Thank you, Judge Smith.
Last case for today, United States versus Laura Alberto.